government aid, levy limits, and local sales tax.
I manage a bigger staff. Excuse me. I am also from Muscle Research. I do some property tax, alcohol, tobacco tax, mining taxes, and then there's a sheet in there that has all the various ones that I was on.
Thank you.
Steve Hines from Muscle Research, and I do property taxes, fiscal disparities, and also county program aid. Property tax is probably my dad.
Thank you.
Can everybody are over here?
Nina Mansi, House Research. I do individual income tax, including individual income tax modeling and property tax refunds for both homeowners and renters.
Joel Michael from House Research. And for those of you who can't remember what everybody said they do, in your folder there is a sheet that has on one side our names and the basic tax types that both the House Research and fiscal staff do, and then on the back side there's more detail. So we're not expecting you to remember, and if you can't remember, just call anybody and they'll send you to who the right person is. So
okay, thank you. And then if we can just have all the members quickly, you know, name in your city, not your tax agenda, please. As I look at former Speaker Zellers, please. No, I'm just kidding. So Representative Zellers, how about if you start? We're just saying who we are and where we represent.
Kurt, I'm a Libra, I believe it. No. Kurt Zellers, District 34B, cities of Osseo and Maple Grove.
I'm Sarah Anderson. I represent Plymouth.
Linda Runbeck, District 38A, which is Circle Pines, all the way east to Hugo.
State Representative Paul Markwart from the city of Dilworth, and it's an honor to be serving on this committee again, especially with you, Chair Lincheski. And I'm just going to mention to rookie members that when you have a bill to present to this committee, have your policy debate in good form, because the political doesn't work with this, Madam Chair. So have the policy in order when you come to this committee. So
I don't know about that. Representative Barrett.
Yes. Representative Bob Barrett from Chisago County, including the cities of North Branch, Wyoming, and Lindstrom, among others.
Hey, I'm Myra. I represent the city of Savage and also a little bit of Burnsville.
I'm Tara Mack and represent Apple Valley and part of Lakeville.
Steve Druskowski, Southeast Minnesota, portions of Wabasha, Goodhue, Winona, and Dodge Counties.
Tina Liebling, part of Rochester.
Jennifer Loon, Eden Prairie.
Joyce Pepin, Dayton, Rogers, and part of Maple Grove, District 34A.
And I'm State Representative Diane Loeffler from Minneapolis.
Ann Lincheski, Bloomington.
Rick Hansen, South St. Paul, West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Mendota, and Lilydale.
Dan Schoen, Great Cloud Island Township, Newport, St. Paul Park, South St. Paul, and Cottage Grove.
Eric Simonson, west half of Duluth.
Tom Anfield, Iron Range, and Cass County.
Linda Slocum, Richfield, and Bloomington.
John Benson, Minnetonka, Plymouth.
Leon Lilly, North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale.
Paymar, St. Paul.
Carly Moline, Central to Western, Iron Range, portions of St. Louis and Itasca counties.
And I'm Lyndon Carlson. I have a large part of Crystal, most of New Hope, and part of Plymouth these days. And I was first on the tax committee in 1973. And then, as speakers do, they changed the schedules, and I had to choose between ending up being chair of the Education Division of Appropriations or being on taxes. But I've been back now for the past few years, so enjoy being on the tax committee again.
Jim Dabney, Minneapolis. I also chair the Property and Local Sales Tax or Local Tax Division of this committee.
Thank you. So we'll ask folks as they come in to just introduce themselves. And I just wanted to talk about a couple housekeeping things first, which are to say that we're not going to take attendance here. Folks have been on this committee know that from past years. You don't need to call Emily or Gina. If you're not here, you're excused. You're not going to be marked absent. We know members are very busy and meet with their constituents regularly and are in and out of the room. So you're excused or you're here, and you'll be marked one way or the other. I don't intend to adopt rules unless someone has a burning need to. I think in the past this committee's demonstrated that it likes to be kind of a little on the wild side with no germaneness and no 24-hour rule. So that's my intention, unless some folks on the committee want to get into that. And then I only wanted to say that Representative Davids is the lead and wanted to be here, and we haven't heard, maybe someone can tell us, but he's supposed to be a grandfather today. Can someone tell us what's going on there? Who knows the information?
It's a boy.
It's a boy. Okay. Well, great for Representative Davids. I'm sure we'll hear all about it when he's back. Is there anything else initially that anybody wants to talk about? Otherwise, we'll just go to the bill. Okay. And if that's the case, what I'm going to do is just ask the nonpartisan staff to do the bill, even though I'm an author of one. There are two bills on the agenda. I just want folks to know Representative Davids and I have the exact same bill down to the period. So I thought it would be easier, is rather than me presenting it and then Representative Davids presenting another day, we'll just have the staff go through the bill and just know that House File 6 and House File, I believe it's 63. So after we hear them, we can, in fact, I think if someone would like to move one of them, we can get it before us. So Representative Anderson moves House File 6. And I guess, can we take two motions at the same time? Can we move the Davids bill, too? I guess we'll have to remember to do that later so that we can get that one done. Okay, so with that, we're going to take up federal conformity. And I'll just say the bill before us is just federal conformity for 2012, the tax year that is passing. So this doesn't attempt to address conformity going forward, which will be an issue for this committee going forward. Preliminarily, I thought it's worth mentioning that usually bipartisanly, most years, the tax committee has been quick in the House to pass conformity when it benefits our taxpayers. Usually what it's doing is passing on tax benefits for Minnesotans, and that's what this bill does. It affects about 250,000 filers if we don't conform. And we'll hear as the bill gets walked through the numerous provisions that are in there. I know there's some folks from the public want to testify, and we'd like to hear from the governor's office as well. But I think the easier way is to just have Mr. Michael and Ms. Manzi join us at the table and walk through the bill, and we can just take questions on provisions as we go. So if that's all right, if the two of you would. And maybe a little intro to help the background on what we're about here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Nina Manzi from House Research. A little background. Minnesota's individual income tax, as we'll talk about more in the overview of taxes tomorrow, relies on the federal income tax for many of its definitions, including the definition of federal taxable income. It does this by reference to the Internal Revenue Code as of a specific date. And you'll see that if you look at section one of the bill, if you look on, let's see, page two, you'll see there's a date there on page two, line 10. It says the Internal Revenue Code of 1986, as amended through April 14th, 2011, shall be in effect for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 1996. So that's the current law with reference to our definition of taxable income. We use taxable income as the Federal Internal Revenue Code defined it through that date. Since that date, the Congress has enacted two laws that have affected the definition of federal taxable income. One of them was relatively minor, the Federal Aviation Modernization Act, which was enacted last year toward the end of our legislative session. And then one of them that was fairly major, which you all probably aware of, the so-called fiscal cliff bill, which was enacted a few weeks ago and signed by the president in early January. The Congress has in recent years enacted laws that have changed the definition of federal taxable income for the current tax year, or even for the tax year that has just completed relatively late in the year, which has left states that rely on federal taxable income as their starting point for their income tax in the position of having to decide what to do so their departments of revenue can prepare the forms for the filing season, which is about to start. And that's the situation that we're in this year. We've been in that situation pretty much every other year for the last 6 years. We had an early conformity bill for 1 year only in 2011, in 2009, and in 2007. Some of them enacted more quickly than others. So there's some precedent for what we're doing now for this bill to conform for 1 year only. As the chair said, the idea is to get things in order for tax year 12, which ended on December 31st of last year, give the Department of Revenue some direction as to what to put on the forms for additions and subtractions and modifications to taxable income for tax year 12 so that people can begin filing their returns and either make their final payments or get their refunds. So that's the background. Then probably the best way to see what the federal bill actually did and its effect on Minnesota's income tax is to look at the summary, because when you look at the bill itself, all you see is a change in the date. There are a lot of words there on page 2, and what those words are doing are updating to the Internal Revenue Code as of January 3rd, 2013, for tax year 12 only. So as the chair said, it leaves tax year 13 and following years on the table and doesn't take action with regard to those. It would just address tax year 12. The other sections of the bill update the date in other sections in the property tax refund chapter and in a second place in the income tax chapter. And then the final section I'll talk about a little bit later, it provides for some amended returns for a federal law that had a retroactive impact. The summary goes through and describes the things that the federal government did to change federal taxable income. The main changes for tax year 12 were to extend the higher education tuition deduction, which is a deduction of up to $4,000, to extend the educator classroom expense deduction, allow for individuals age 70 and a half and older to transfer up to $100,000 from an IRA directly to a qualified charity, extension of increased adjusted gross income limits on conservation easements that can be claimed as a charitable deduction, numerous provisions related to depreciation and expensing of different kinds of property, and then the one provision that was in the Federal Aviation Modernization Act, which was to allow airline employees who received bankruptcy payments to retroactively roll the payments over into traditional IRAs in the year in which the payments were received. That's a provision that the Tax Committee heard last year in a bill that was authored by Representative Atkins, and that bill ultimately didn't advance last year, but it would be picked up by the date update for tax year 12 in this bill. The one major provision that's in the federal change to taxable income for tax year 12 that House File 6 and House File 63 would not conform to would be the increased Section 179 expensing limits for tax year 12. Minnesota has not conformed to the increased federal Section 179 expensing limits since 2006, and instead has required people to add to taxable income 80% of the difference between the increased amount and the previous underlying amount, and then to take one-fifth of the amount added back as a subtraction in each of the next 5 years, so that when you add it up over time, if you disregard the time value of money, it adds up to zero over the six-year period. It's what the federal government is doing is a timing issue to accelerate recognition of the expense into the future. And when they did this in 2006, the legislature and the governor started on a path of saying that we couldn't afford to do the same thing that they did, and instead put in place this other mechanism for dealing with it, which subsequent legislatures have continued as the federal government has continued to allow for increased Section 179 expensing. I'm going to see if Mr. Michael wants to add anything. If any of you have any questions about the items listed in the summary, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Mr. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the qualified conservation property, and you referenced the easements. And for is that for a donated easement or donated partial value? Let's say if the state purchased an easement and the seller donated an amount so that the reduced cost was there. Could you maybe just explain that that provision a little bit more?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, this essentially there under the charitable contribution deduction, there are limits that apply when you contribute property, particularly appreciated or capital gain property, that restrict your ability to deduct the fair market value. Previously there were special rules that have been amended several times by Congress, and then they're sunset, so they need to be extended, that allow, as you're indicating, donations of conservation easements to qualify for essentially a fair market value deduction. And there are special rules that apply to farmers and ranchers, and the federal legislation extends those rules for, I think, another five tax years, if I recall right, or two tax years. And so what this would do is, you know, essentially adopt those federal rules for Minnesota purposes. So individuals in Minnesota who own land and contribute conservation easements to either a charity or a governmental entity, oftentimes the contributions are made to a governmental entity, they would be able to deduct the fair market value of those of that easement.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and thank you. And this is a personal or an individual, so let's say an individual donates it to a NGO, and then the NGO donates it to the state. Is it the individual that takes that can apply under the special rules, or can the NGO apply under the special rules?
Mr. Mike.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, it's the owner of the land that gets the tax deduction, and you're right. In some instances, they will go through a nonprofit like the Land Conservancy or something like that, but sometimes they will go directly to the government. Either way, they're deductible. And it's just these rules allow a higher value to be deducted than otherwise would be the case under the sort of old default rules that apply to appreciated property. The appreciated property normally, except in certain circumstances, you're limited to deducting your basis. You know, essentially the cost that you have in the property. And there are also restrictions on donations of fractional interests and properties. And these conservation easement rules sort of provide an exception to those limitations as a way to encourage people to make those sorts of donations.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's good information. The fiscal implications that are in the spreadsheet in front of us, is that based on just past practice on what we've seen for this special rule, or does the Revenue Department track these at all?
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, the estimates in the bill, as probably someone will talk about later, are mixed. Some of them are estimated using Minnesota data from our income tax model. This one, though, is simply, I believe, an allocation of the federal estimates to Minnesota, so it does not necessarily reflect past donations of these types of easements in Minnesota.
And we will go through the spreadsheet after
right.
We're through the bill. Mr. Michael.
One other thing that I would like to, would like to add for the new members on the committee to sort of supplement what Ms. Manzi said. I mean, the obvious question that some of you may be asking is, why don't we just adopt federal law, including changes that Congress subsequently enacted? And the answer to that is that the legislature back in the 1960s, in fact, did that. They said, well, if Congress changes the law, we're going to automatically adopt those changes. That would avoid the need to go through this annual exercise and the angst that it causes for tax preparers, taxpayers, the Department of Revenue, and so forth. Well, the Minnesota Supreme Court, in I think 1971 or something thereabout, said that was an unconstitutional delegation of the legislature's power to Congress, and so that's why we have to go through this almost virtually annual exercise of adopting the new changes that Congress enacts, because the Minnesota Supreme Court says the legislature cannot do that under the Constitution.
Thank you. More on the bill? Other questions? Otherwise, we can go to the spreadsheet. Okay, I think we'll go to the spreadsheet. And I think, especially for new members, but it's good for members who maybe haven't sat on here very long or have and haven't really wanted to pay attention to learn this, I think it's worth Ms. Templin reminding the members how to read a tax committee spreadsheet, because tax committee is not like all the other committees. We have, I think it's better to have Ms. Templin and Ms. Schill, whoever wants to first tell us how to read a spreadsheet in the tax committee. Very different than other committees.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, unlike other fiscal committees, there are two fiscal analysts on the tax committee because of the because there's almost double the members and there's quite a variety of issues. Just really quickly, I wanted to point out in your packets you have a quick synopsis of what a revenue estimate is. For half of you, you probably already know this, but for the new members, this is just an overview of the difference between revenue estimates and fiscal notes. And we will be going over this just really quickly before we go over the revenue estimate for House File 6, if that works.
Okay, and Ms. Templin, I'm just, we had a duplicating issue, and so Kyle and Kelly are handing out an easier to read spreadsheet. But if just to underline something Ms. Templin said for new members, other committees use fiscal notes. The tax committee uses revenue estimates. So it's just something we're going to try to get everybody remembering. It just takes a while. So now they're going to teach us the difference here for a second. Okay. Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair, to start out, this committee uses mostly revenue estimates. There are a few instances where fiscal notes are needed. But to start, the department or the committee focuses on official revenue estimates. And so for every bill hearing, there is a revenue estimate. And these are produced not by the Minnesota Management and Budget, but by the Department of Revenue. And they produce the official estimates. And these estimates show the change in tax collections or state expenditures for property tax relief programs. The department does the official analysis because they have the official data, they have confidential taxpayer returns, they have the information to produce the official estimates. Nonpartisan staff can produce unofficial estimates for and House research for many of the taxes. Just something to keep in mind. In addition, revenue estimates, you'll see one in a few minutes, they provide an explanation of the estimating methodology used, including comments on the interpretation of the statutory language. All of the revenue estimates are based on the latest financial forecast. So the estimate today is based on the November 2012 forecast. And the revenue estimates will show the change to current law tax revenues. And in most cases, it's changes to the general fund tax revenues. In general, estimates provide static analysis, but sometimes behavioral responses are sometimes taken into account. For example, for cigarette and liquor tax estimates, elasticity adjustments are made. DOR believes there is a generally accepted methodology for estimating the magnitude of a behavioral change. Also, in revenue estimates, if there is a modification in one tax, that can lead to behavioral responses that change the base of another tax or credit. If this occurs, these behavioral responses are noted as interactions. As an example, property tax estimates often include estimates for such an interaction when property tax increases may result in an increase in itemized income tax deductions. Also, revenue estimates do not account for secondary estimates, such as the economic impact of a particular project. And then revenue estimates also assume 100% compliance. So how do you request a revenue estimate after all of this? You contact one of us, and we can work with the department on getting a bill proposal estimated. All requests are confidential. I should take a step back. Before a bill is introduced, if you want to get a revenue estimate, before it's publicly introduced, we can get an estimate from the department in most cases. Once the bill is publicly introduced and there is an estimate on it, it will be publicly, it will be put on the Department of Revenue's website. So that's just something to keep in mind. So if you have an idea and you're not sure, you want to introduce it as a bill and you just want to get an estimate, we can get a confidential estimate for you. Other things to keep in mind, when there is a hearing on a bill, they will always have a revenue estimate. Revenue estimates may be requested on bills that do not have a hearing. However, they are given a lower priority. This is particularly important during the height of session. The department doesn't have the resources to get to all the revenue estimates. They in most cases always get done, but it's not. If they don't have a hearing, they get done later. I guess if there's a revenue estimate if there's an estimate that you don't agree with that is an official, please don't hesitate to contact us. There may be a different interpretation, and we can work with the department on getting things clarified. And all revenue estimates are available on the Department of Revenue's website, and there is a link in this document. It's a good link to bookmark to get all the revenue estimates. The author of a bill will always get a revenue estimate emailed to him or her.
Michelle.
Okay, Madam Chair, members, my name is Kathy Schill. I'm also from House Fiscal. We have a couple of other tools that we use to help tracking in this committee as well. One, as you are familiar with, is probably fiscal notes. Fiscal notes identify the price tag of proposed legislation, focusing on state agency changes, both in expenditures and at time for revenues that would result from a bill becoming law. But the focus that we look at here in the tax committee is that those fiscal notes apply to administrative costs for relative state agencies, sometimes one agency, sometimes several agencies, and this is overseen by the Office of Management and Budget with all agencies listed in the bill. One trick that we use that is done by our friends in Department of Revenue, when you have a revenue estimate and it has a fiscal note impact, there's a little box over here. And it is either checked or not checked. And this one, particularly for House File 6, has an X checked under yes for potential DOR administrative costs and savings. That will give you a clue that you should look for the second tool, which is a fiscal note, to also help you get the overall impact of what this bill could be. In practice, as Ms. Templin says, we usually use revenue estimates in this committee, but a fiscal note is also prepared at different times during the process. We usually get fiscal impacts in an overall sense as we pass the bill into conference or onto the floor, a big measure that will take into account all the changes for the omnibus tax bill. Once again, a fiscal note for a tax bill need only be requested if the law change would have an impact on the administrative costs. That would include a new line on the tax return. It could be the administration of a program. It could actually be things like printing and mailing costs. Otherwise, we would probably focus just on the tool of a revenue estimate. Once again, if you need a fiscal note on a bill, you can come to Ms. Templin or me to ask for it by this particular committee. And the other thing, if you have questions on the content of fiscal notes, you probably get this information in other committees, there is a money matter specifically dealing with the content of fiscal notes and how they are structured on our website. And we could either provide you the link or the hard copy, whatever your pleasure. The other tool that we use, and I'll move on to page 3 of your handout, is a local impact note. And basically we use this tool when we are concerned about changes being mandated on local governments. A local impact note estimates the local government or school district fiscal impact of a proposed legislation or rule. There are particular elements that need to be considered when you're seeking a local impact because it is not housed only in management and budget for the analysis. They actually seek out their counterparts at the local level, whether it be school districts, counties, cities, or such, to gather information. So the process for a local impact note may take several weeks compared to the fiscal note process that is, five to seven days is what they have recommend for this. And the other thing you should know, local impact notes can only be requested by the chair of taxes, the House or Senate, and then the House Finance Committee members as well, also the ranking minorities of each of those committees. So the focus is way narrower than what you would find for a request for a fiscal note. Moving to tracking sheets.
Madam Chair, on the next page after fiscal notes, there's just an example of a spreadsheet that shows general fund revenues and property tax revenues. The general fund revenues is like this, and I apologize for the minutia. It got kind of reduced. It looks smaller. So if you have your microscope, you can follow along with me. Basically, what we want to just convey on taxes spreadsheets is, as an example, this is a spreadsheet of general fund tax revenues. It is based on the November forecast, and it shows current law tax revenues. Just as an aside, the committee sometimes looks at non-general fund revenues, but this spreadsheet looks at general fund revenues. And when you're looking at tax revenues, positive numbers show positive revenues, and negative numbers show a reduction in revenues. So as an example, on line 10 of this spreadsheet of revenues, under column L, that shows the biennial total for income tax revenues. It is $16.493 billion for the fiscal 12-13 biennium. And then moving all the way down to the total at the bottom of the sheet, line 57, it shows there are $32.1 billion in general fund tax revenues for the fiscal 12-13 biennium. Again, positive numbers show positive revenue gain, and negative numbers are revenue reductions. That is different from fiscal committees, and we just wanted to underline that today in our discussion.
And the last two pages, once again, this is the spending side of the tax spreadsheet. It represents tax aids and credits. And in contrary to the revenue side of the spreadsheet, a positive number represents an increase in expenditures, and a negative number represents a decrease in expenditures. So it's kind of flip side from what you see on the revenue sheet. So I guess the lesson here is make sure you know which sheet you are looking at, and if it's ever in question, please ask one of us. The last two pages that you'll see with tax aids and credits gives you, once again, the base level of spending for defined by the November 2012 forecast. If you go to the very last sheet, it says page 3 of 3, and you'll see under column fiscal 12 to 13, total spending for tax aids and credits for the 12 to 13 biennium, which we are about to complete, is $2.8 billion. Then I have a line there that says less PILT, which is payment in lieu of taxes. That is one item that we'll have a discussion later on, but that item in particular, which has traditionally been tracked in this committee, will now be tracked in the Natural Resources Committee. So our bottom line total, and I'm very clear about comparisons from year to year, so we make sure that we're talking apples to apples. The property tax aids and credits total less PILT will be $2.75 billion. And we can dwell on that at another point. I think it's time to probably go back to House File 6 and let you know that we'll be tracking changes from these base level totals when we do our overall spreadsheet with the committee.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before we go on, could you just give us a little explanation, a little more on why we do it one way on the revenue note and the other way on this expenditures? I mean, it's always confusing. And I'm sure I'm not the only one who's confused by this. And just could you just sort of give us something to help us figure out, you know, how to keep that straight in our minds, why we do it that way, and how do you keep it straight?
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, in the House, and this is basically taken by direction of House Fiscal, we have all finance committees using the same format. And so when you have spending and aids and credits and you take a look at that spreadsheet, it would be equal to the spending in any other committee. But you can't do that as easily for revenue. So we decided to have revenue as they are presented by the revenue estimates that we receive. In the Senate, they do it differently for taxes. They consider it all by definition of revenue and what how Department of Revenue presents it. The House just chooses to have it done differently.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, it's past convention. It's just the convention of the Tax Committee, and I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Paymer.
Is this okay to ask a question?
Sure. Okay. We do have three testifiers, and we want to hear from the governor on governor's office on the bill. No, that's fine, because we're on it. So,
I mean, it's interesting. I'm just curious about the, on the first page, the accepted methodology for estimating the magnitude of behavioral changes when you for instance, increase the taxes on cigarettes or alcohol. What can you say something about what that methodology is, and maybe I'm confusing the revenue estimates with the fiscal notes, but I wonder why then we can't bank some policy changes in the same, using the same methodology. Could you understand?
Yeah, Representative Paymar, Madam Chair. Yes, this is an issue that comes up frequently. In the Department of Revenue, obviously, could provide more detail, but what they've told me is that they have an accepted methodology where they can make elasticity adjustments in the revenue estimate. As an example, cigarettes, the excise tax is 48 cents per pack. If there was a proposal to increase the tax to $10 per pack, they adjust the elasticity so that the revenue gain is, you know, it's an elastic consumption, so the revenue gain is adjusted accordingly. So that is a methodology they're comfortable incorporating into the into the revenue estimates. There have been other proposals where they also do that. Excuse me for alcohol taxes. There are other areas where the department has explained to us that they do not have the resources or the expertise to make adjustments to their estimates.
So there's not a correlation then between policy using that same methodology that policy changes then would be factored into with fiscal notes. If you made a policy change, that you could bank that change so there were less expenditures. I'm thinking something like in the criminal justice area where if you invest in drug courts and things like that, why can't that same methodology be used for the amount of money, the amount of resources for the courts individuals coming into the criminal justice?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymore, that is a good question. Again, keep in mind that the revenue estimates are completed by the Department of Revenue and the fiscal notes are coordinated by the Minnesota Management and Budget Department, and they are and they work with the appropriate agencies on their estimates. So that is a good question, and it's probably should be directed at MMB and the appropriate agencies.
Thank you.
And I think the Department of Revenue is here, so they can anticipate that in the next few weeks here, we're going to want to know more about that. And I think this is something, as Ms. Schill and Ms. Templin are raising, that comes up from both sides of the aisle on a regular basis. Why is there dynamic modeling here and not there? Why is there elasticity here and not there? I think part of it is what there is broad consensus on by all economists on both sides. So when you have empirical data to show that people do things with tobacco, there's sort of a consensus. If you have an issue like cutting taxes, some people can bring out the data to show that absolutely will, you know, not fund our government and be worse, and others can say, you know, cutting taxes will be a huge stimulative effect to the economy. And the data isn't quite clear on that. You know, there's not a broad consensus that a certain tax act does a certain thing, except for in a few areas. I mean, there are a few that I think have been demonstrated broadly, but I think that's part of what we all debate in here. What would revenue show us would happen with a certain tax cut or tax decrease? But the way I always think about the two spreadsheets, to Representative Liebling's question, that I think is kind of helps me anyhow, is this is the only committee that both spends and raises. And every other committee spends what target they get. We raise and spend. So we have to track the raising side, not just the spending side, so that when somebody offers to cut something, we lose that part of the revenue. So we're following that revenue gain or loss by a tax increase or a tax cut or a tax expenditure. And then we have the spending side, which is the local government aid and, you know, the property tax refund. So this is the one committee that's really got both sides of the ledger going on compared to most committees. So it is confusing, and I think people just spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to do it. The thing that helps me the most is to just look at the little writing at the very top. Every time you read a spreadsheet, just reminds you, what are you looking at? Because sometimes you think you're reading a positive and you're reading a negative. And that's really important for this committee to understand that. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I had, the local impact notes, they seem to be really geared toward measuring the impact of proposals that would result in growing local government. I know I've offered proposals in the past that would ostensibly shrink local government, and we don't measure the net savings to local government of certain proposals. Why is that?
Michelle.
Madam Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I would think it's an element of time and resources, really. We try to gather as much information as possible to assist MMB in the changes proposed by a bill on where information can be received. And a lot of time you will get case in point testimony coming back as the the local impact note is being devised on how the impact will be. So I would say you can get a case in point, but to get an overall local impact that would be comprehensive, I think just within our time frame, that time and resources don't allow for that. And we can check into that further if you'd wish, but I basically that's what we have with the time span that we have to work with.
Further?
I don't know my question's been answered, Madam Chair, but thank you, Ms. Schill, and in the interest of time, I'll take it easy here.
Thank you. So to the bill. We're going to go through the spreadsheet, I think, you know, fairly quickly here. People can just see it. We don't need to do it line by line. We do want to get testimony on the bill before we adjourn. Oh, Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The four sheets, the spreadsheets that we can't really read, can we get readable copies next meeting?
Representative Runbeck, I said the exact same thing when I came in here. You know, we're all getting older. And so this little text, I mean, well, this is little.
Speak for yourself.
So
read it.
We are, okay, so and there's two, Representative Runbeck. The first set that was in the packet was cut off, so duplicating is running again, and you should have that one too. Should be a little easier to read. And we're going to look at the page, and just for members to recall, this is both Representative David's bill and the same bill I have. It's the exact same spreadsheet for both House File 6 and House File 63. So, Ms. Templin, looked right at you and called you the wrong name. Apologize.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are three revenue estimates pertaining to federal conformity and House, and they look, and the revenue estimates have the Minnesota revenue header at the top. If you'd like, you could pull these revenue estimates out to follow along. House File 6 and House File 63, the revenue estimates are identical. The numbers are exactly the same, and so you can treat them as the same. There is, there's also a revenue estimate, that does not have the Minnesota revenue letterhead. And it looks like this, and this is a revenue estimate from the department, and it is the estimate for federal tax conformity for all provisions and for all tax years. The department also distributed this, and it is an official revenue estimate.
So, Ms. Templin, so members, you guys have all these. Okay, so one easy way to see this, if full conformity is $160 million, and we're looking at just 2012. So one's got the full price tag. This has the year. So I think we want to go through the bill itself.
Madam Chair, looking at the revenue estimate for House File 6, just for simplicity, again, this is the revenue estimate for federal conformity for 1 year only, for tax year 12. Going through this estimate, estimate shows the changes to general fund tax revenues with the adoption of this bill. As an example, if you look at the first line of the revenue estimate, it shows the American Taxpayer Relief Act, and then it has the individual income tax and the corporate franchise tax. It has the revenue impact bifurcated for each fiscal year per tax type. For example, for individual income tax, the revenue reduction is $14.1 million in fiscal 13. For corporate tax, the revenue reduction with this bill is $3 million, for a total change of $17.1 million in fiscal 13. For the FAA Modernization Act, the change to individual income tax revenues, the estimate is negative, or a revenue reduction of $1.4 million in fiscal 13, for a total general fund change in fiscal 13 of $18.5 million. And this, again, is an estimated revenue reduction. Rather than going through every year, I will just, again, look at the total for fiscal 17. There is a cost going out 5 years. The cost in fiscal 17 is, or the revenue reduction is $1.17 million. Below the revenue, below that is an explanation of the department's methodology for coming up with these estimates. And then the subsequent pages show the detail for each of the provisions in the bill. Now, I put together a spreadsheet for this bill that uses the information in the revenue estimate. The spreadsheet looks like this. It shows at the top, I put the note about positive dollars represent revenue gain and negative dollars represent a revenue reduction. This is the spreadsheet for House File 6. And if you have that in your hand, you can see that lines 7 through 17 are tax year 13 provisions that are not included in House File 16. House File 6, excuse me. And then lines 19 through 49 of the spreadsheet show federal provisions that are temporarily extended in tax year 12 in House File 6. For example, line 21 in fiscal 13, there's the deduction for educator classroom expenses for $250. The estimated revenue reduction is $1.1 million in fiscal 13 and with no revenue impact in later years. Madam Chair, for the sake of time, should I just go through the provisions with a revenue impact of over $1 million? For each of these?
Sure, that sounds fine, unless folks want more detail. I mean, I think they're pretty, you're just seeing the price of all the different provisions. And I think this spreadsheet really helps members see how important conformity is, because each one of these is so complicated that if we didn't conform, the taxpayer would really imagine them trying to handle this. But, yeah, maybe hit the highlights, and maybe the ones that are most known, the tuition, the teacher expensing, the IRAs.
Okay. Okay, we just went through line 21, which was the deduction for educator classroom expenses up to $250, and that is for tax year 12. And I just want to note that the line above it shows, on line 20, shows the cost of conformity for tax year 12 and 13. It shows the biennial cost. So that's just a reference point. Moving on to line 24, I just want to mention line 24. The Department of Revenue shows revenue impact that is negligible. Negligible means an impact of $5,000 or less. If it's a negative negligible, that means negative $5,000 or less. Line 26 is the premium for mortgage insurance deductible as qualified resident interest. That is an estimated revenue reduction in fiscal 13 of $3.9 million in tax year 12. On line 30, there is the deduction of qualified tuition and related expenses in tax year 12. The estimated reduction is in fiscal 13 is $5.3 million. Moving to the second page, on line 32, the tax-free IRA distributions up to $100,000 to certain public charities for individuals ages 70 and a half. The estimated revenue reduction is $1.7 million in fiscal 13 with impact through fiscal 17. Line 34, I will go all the way to the bottom to line 43. This is the subtotal for the provisions in House File 6 that were temporarily extended to individuals in tax year 12. The subtotal is $14.1 million in fiscal 13. And in the biennium for 2014 and 15, there is a positive $210,000 revenue gain. And then in the fiscal 16 and 17 biennium, there is a estimated revenue reduction of $1.355 million. Moving on to the corporate tax provisions, starting on line 51, there are several provisions that have revenue impact. On line 67, there is a provision over $1 million. This is the exception under subpart F for active financing income. There's an estimated revenue reduction of $1.5 million in fiscal 13 and no impact in the tails. The subtotal for corporate taxes on line 61 is an estimated revenue reduction of $3 million in fiscal 13 and an estimated revenue reduction of $240,000 in the 14-15 biennium and an estimated revenue reduction of $855,000 in the 16 and 17 biennium. Okay, moving on to the line 76 or 75 and 76 of this spreadsheet also show the revenue impact of conforming to the FAA Modernization Act. That is on line 76, and it shows an estimated revenue reduction of $1.4 million in fiscal 13 and with a small revenue impact in later biennia. Line 78 of the spreadsheet shows the total revenue impact of these provisions. In fiscal 13, the revenue reduction is $18.5 million, and in fiscal 14 and 15, the estimated revenue reduction is $70,000, and in fiscal 16 and 17, the estimated revenue reduction is $2.2 million, and that is it.
Thank you. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering then on the out years, the out bienniums, those will be revisited, I presume, but some decisions were made now, what, due to the kind of tax reduction that was at federal level, or why is that? Well, why do we extend some and not others into 14-15?
Well, I think this bill is attempting to extend the provisions that Congress afforded for the 2012 tax filing year. And we'll have to make a decision if we want to continue some of those. So, for example, how teachers buy school supplies for their classroom and then they get to deduct it on their taxes, we've kept re-upping that rather than sort of permanently buying that. It allows us to make a decision that, you know, we're not going to pay for the whole thing right now, but it would affect all tax filers who are affected by this bill. Just for those filing their taxes right now, and the idea of taking this up early would be so people file their taxes correctly immediately. If we don't conform, or if we conform in April or May in the omnibus tax bill, here's what happens is people file their taxes wrong, and it's our fault because we didn't do this, and then they find out later because they're not doing them wrong, they think they're doing them right. Then we tell them later, whoops, you know, we changed the rules, you get to amend your taxes. So then we have 250,000 people go amend their taxes. So this would only affect things that are happening on the 2012 form. Some of those Congress intended to go on in perpetuity, and we'll have to make big decisions on them. As you know, Representative Runbeck, that both parties around here have not conformed to everything, and it's usually because of a price tag. An example is the estate tax. Both parties have not conformed on that the whole time I've been here. Because Congress took a permanent action on the estate tax a couple weeks ago, we're going to have to make a decision on that later this year. You know, Minnesota allows you to not count $1 million of your estate when you die, and the Congress now is going to allow you to not count $5 million. So if we don't conform, then those estates will say they're losing a tax benefit. So it's silent on that one because that's something we should, if we can get agreement, we should all try to do by the end of this session. But those other things that are not for tax year 12 are not being dealt with in this bill. This is simply folks who are now getting ready to file their 2012 taxes. And I don't know if Mr. Michael wants to add on that, if I've missed something on that. You know, and I'd like to speak for Representative Davids. He's not here, but I won't do that. Our bill is have the same things, but maybe Mr. Michael, if there's something you want to add.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, I think what you're asking is why are there numbers out in fiscal 14, 15, and so forth for some of these provisions when it only affects tax year 12? Some of these provisions affect things like depreciation rules. So, for example, just, you know, I have my spreadsheet turned to page 3, which is the corporate provision. If you look at the very top one, it says 7-year recovery period for certain motor sports racing track facilities. The way we adopt that for tax year 12 is it said normally that would be a longer lived investment. So rather than 7 years, I don't know what the appropriate recovery period would be, but maybe it's 15 years or 12 years or something like that. So what this says is for a corporation that qualifies for that treatment, if in tax year 12 you put that facility in service, you get the 7 year recovery period, not the 15 year recovery period that would normally apply. So even though we're only adopting this for tax year 12, it has effect on the taxpayers 13, 14, and so forth. And so that's why it shows up, because they're going to be having a slightly faster, a larger allowance in 13. But in order to do it for 12, we have to also adopt it that flows over into those out years. What Representative Lincheski is saying, we're only doing it for tax year 12 and not for 13. That's what you're going to have to decide later on if you vote this out anyway.
Representative Rudnick?
Thank you.
Other questions? If not, we'll go to public testimony. I think, thank you, Ms. Templin and Ms. Schill. And I'm not sure we've heard from three folks. Anybody who wants to come forward or anyone who we didn't hear from, you never have to register testimony. We just want to hear from you. So welcome.
Thank you.
And if you can tell us your name and who you're with for the tape here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susie Brown. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We have 2,000 nonprofit organization members throughout the state, no doubt several in each of your legislative districts. We're really pleased about this conformity because of a particularly important giving opportunity that it brings to Minnesota in the extension of the IRA rollover. We see that as really a benefit to both the taxpayer and the nonprofit organization that a Minnesota citizen might wish to support, and we're grateful that it brings that to Minnesota, in particular that it allows people who are interested in contributing in January 2013 to apply that to their 2012 tax. So thank you.
Thank you. And I hope you all caught that. That's very strange. Congress has gotten trickier every day. They now passed a provision that you can make a charitable gift today and count it in last year's taxes if we pass this law. And it actually will provide more money to charitable organizations. But I don't think we've normally seen Congress do things like that. Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, didn't we do that 1 year when there was an issue about the tsunami and people wanted to make charitable contributions? Because I thought it was pretty strange then.
Yes, Representative Liebling is right. We were trying to get people to give money because I think, did the tsunami happen the first few days of the year?
Christmas.
And so we wanted people to keep giving money, so we tried to give them a tax benefit to do it in January. That's right. Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Todd Koch. I'm from the Minnesota Institute of CPAs. I'm also a tax partner at the CPA firm of John Knutson and Company. I come here with a rare request. I want to be paid less. If you guys comply, I can charge less to do taxes. And that's a good thing, because they're complicated enough. The hard part is the filing season, theoretically this year, has been delayed to the January 30th. If you can get this done timely, we can actually start filing returns January 30th. Instead of figuring out what is or is not going to be complied with. We appreciate you looking at this so early, because I had a full set of hair when I started this job. I no longer have a full set of hair. I'd like to keep a few of the ones I have. So what you can do to do compliance allows people to actually move forward, and I appreciate that you're looking at this now as a bipartisan committee versus having what happened in another congressional session in Washington, D.C., that took a little too long. So we only have 2 weeks to allow us to start timely filing. So even though it looks like we have a lot of time, there really is not if we want to allow people to file returns early. A lot of these provisions are very small. Think of the teacher's reduction. Each individual teacher is worth $15 to $25. $8% of $250, $20. You think someone's going to go back and amend for $20? I'll tell you, I'm going to charge them more than $20 to do it. So if you could get this done ahead of time, you actually will be giving people the benefit. Where some, if you're saying, well, we'll put it in later, they can change later, that doesn't always work. Or you could put it back on the department and say they'll dig them out and send them the checks. Well, then that nice little fiscal note where you have, say, as a reduction in cost, now is going to be in increase in cost. So we appreciate you taking care of this now versus later, and anything we could do to help encourage that, we'd appreciate.
Thank you, and I think Representative Carlson may have a question for you. So please.
You know, there's probably many more than two, but two levels of software that are available, software that CPAs might typically purchase to help with returns, and then TurboTax and so on that individuals may purchase. What's the turnaround time in terms of those companies getting the software up to date to match the conformity? When you talk about when you could begin to file the returns.
Madam Chair, Representative, the turnaround time, even if it's relatively fast, even though they say it's filing season begins January 30th, for most of my clients, I can't start filing till March because they made such a late change to the depreciation rules. They have to reprogram their computers at the IRS. That has to be tested by the software developers. Then they could push it out to people like me and the public at large at TurboTax. I'm sure they're doing their fast. You know, they're going to have internet updates, I'm willing to believe. Again, as you pointed out, I don't use TurboTax. But the delays that can occur, like sometimes when it gets passed, we've had conformity bills passed in April. By the time they're passed the beginning of April, it looks like they're passed timely, but a lot of people have already filed ahead of time. So whatever we can do to allow people to file the returns that you would like them to file, to use the rules that you would like them to have as early as you can, you're really helping to decrease everyone's compliance costs and allow one CPA to keep a few of his hairs. So,
thank you.
Thank you very
much. Thank you. Welcome. And we do want to hear from the governor's folks on this bill before we finish today, too. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Eric Hall. I'm a pilot with Delta Airlines, formerly Northwest. And I'm a first officer on the 767, primarily international. I'm here today on fairly short notice, filling in for Captain Bruce Endler, who's been working the IRA rollover issue with the state. So I'll do my best to give you, if I could, just a brief synopsis of why we're here. Earlier in 2007, when Northwest emerged from bankruptcy, along with other carriers, Delta and United, airline employees, not just pilots, but all airline employees were involved in a bankruptcy claim note, depending on the severity of their pay cuts, terminated pensions, or frozen pensions. Those claim notes were paid out as regular income between 2007 and 2009 as taxable income. And backing up to last year, when the Federal Aviation Administration Modernization and Reform Act was passed, it allowed airline employees that were paid those claim notes to move the money into an IRA. And what we're looking for from the state is the ability to amend our state returns to conform with what we did on a federal level as well.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions?
Some members will remember this legislation from last year. So thank you. Questions from anyone? Okay, well, thank you for being here, Mr. Hall. We appreciate it. Thank you so much. And Ms. Von Mosch, if you could tell everybody, for new folks to the committee, who you are.
Thank
Please.
You, Madam Chair. My name is Susan Von Mosch. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy for the Department of Revenue. I'm happy to be here today. Do you have any specific questions?
Your thoughts on conformity or the bill or anything you might want to tell us or any concerns you have?
Well, I think there are two different ways of for me to speak about this, and the first would be from the perspective of the department itself that administers the tax code and that would be administering the filing and the returns of income taxes. And basically, from that perspective, conformity as early as possible, as people have already testified to, will be a great benefit to the taxpayer. So that if there is conformity before people start actively filing, taxpayers really would not have to do anything terribly different. If there is not conformity until later, and we as an agency are already working on a form that we call the M1NC, and the NC stands for non-conformity conformity, and that means any item that the Minnesota does not conform to, taxpayers would be required to add that amount back into their state earnings or their taxable income. So that we are working on developing that form, not knowing what is really going to happen. That form would be out there by the end of the month, by the 30th, when both the IRS and Minnesota starts processing tax returns. We would also get that form to the software vendors, and I don't have good information, Representative Carlson, on your question. I do know that in 2011, when we faced this situation, TurboTax did load and use that that form, the M1NC, electronically, so that was part of TurboTax. I don't have information on other software vendors, and I can see about getting that for you in terms of the turnaround time and who picked up that electronic form. So the position of the department, or the perspective of the department, is that for the ease of making things easier for taxpayers, early conformity is a benefit from that perspective. And I know you have mentioned the governor's. The governor does not have a position at this point in time on federal tax conformity.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Von Mosch? If not, members, we're not going to vote on this today. I talked to Representative Davids about that, and I know he'll want to be here, and we're going to have further discussions with the Senate and the governor's office, ASAP, and hopefully we can take a vote on this bill still this week. So other than that, that's all I know. Unless there's questions, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you want us to move then House File 63?
Oh, thank you for reminding me. So I'm going to lay over House File 6 for possible or for further consideration, and Representative Anderson now moves House File 63, and I'll lay that over to another date for possible consideration. Oh, and one other thing. We're all trying to get back in the groove here, right? I'm going to refer these bills to the Property and Local Tax Division, House File 2, Dabney, House File 24, Mullery, House File 39, Purcell, House File 52, Mullery, House File 57, Dill, and House File 58, Dill. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.